You're listening to Bigfoot Live, starring Thomas Gardy, the world's most respected authority on the phenomena known as Bigfoot. Sit back and relax as we take you on a journey into the world of the unknown. Believer or skeptic, man or woman, you will be mesmerized by real people telling real descriptions about real encounters. Fasten your seatbelts, America. It's reality radio at its finest, and it starts now.
In 1967, my whole life changed. I saw the Roger Patterson film on the Johnny Carson show. And I gotta tell you, that's the day I thought I was gonna challenge the world and go out and find this thing.
We had found like 12 tracks in the ground. I didn't want to believe it was Bigfoot.
Oh, yeah.
He's moving right now. He's moving right now. He's straight out of the tree line. He's moving to the right. See him? He's going to the right. He's going into the trees right now. Come here, look.
I'm Bob Hallmark, and I'm a reporter with ABC Television in Tyler, Longview. It's been my pleasure to be with Tom Scotty and his team tonight, and I have to admit that I was skeptical. When I came out here, I thought we, at this time in our history, had the technology to be able to find one of these things if it existed. But after seeing the footprints and the dig marks in the sand and what I believe to be a very large creature running at a high rate of speed through the woods, I'm convinced I'm going to have to change my opinion on Bigfoot.
I turned, I saw this thing standing by my gator.
When I saw the actual footprints, I realized they were something special and probably Sasquatch.
When I landed on the ground, I was kind of thinking, this ain't no human being. It's got to be something else.
www.searchingforbigfoot.com.
Out in the swamps, what you think I've seen? Something strange, you know. Sasquatch sitting on his cypress knee, and he was talking to Moxon Joe. Where the party gonna hell? Out in the St. John's swamps. Sasquatch doing a brand new dance, and he called it the Bigfoot Stomp.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is Marco Bill on the Bigfoot Live broadcast. And folks, it's that time of the week again. It's time for the Wednesday evening Bigfoot Live radio show with our host, Mr. Tom Biscardi. And now, everybody, the man who put the big back into Bigfoot, our host and renowned Bigfoot researcher, Mr. Tom Biscardi. Good evening, Tom. How are you tonight?
Well, you know, I got to tell you, I am fantabulous. And let me tell you the reason why, folks. Just returned from a 16-day expedition, 21 states across this beautiful nation of ours. And we're kicking off this show with probably one of the best subject matters ever, okay? And that's that good old good one called the Patty Film, as they've labeled it. It's been the holy grail in the Bigfoot industry, ladies and gentlemen. Well, you know, somebody's got to go out and see what we've done, and we've done a phenomenal job, ladies and gentlemen. And we have debunked it. It's been debunked a few times, but for some reason, I have no idea why there's so many people around this nation, globally, around the world, who have taken this thing to another dimension. Well, guess what? Whatever is built and goes to the top will be brought down. And it's going to be brought down by us, a conglomerate of people. that have spent their time, their money, their lives, and if they've been suppressed. I'm going to add that to it also, because two authors that I know of, there are probably others out there, but two main ones and one real main one, a good friend of mine, a guy named Greg Long up in Washington, he wrote a book called The Making of Bigfoot. Not a lot of people know that, due to the fact that there's a lot of haters out there in this country, ladies and gentlemen, related to this Patty film. A lot of bashers, a lot of people who are just out there in left field. Well, there's the old adage, if you ever saw, I forget the name of that movie, but, you know, we're not going to take it anymore. So what we're doing is we've collectively come together, my good friend Greg Long, in the making of the book called The Making of Bigfoot, The Inside Story. My dear friend, Mr. Bob Hieronymus, who is was Roger Patterson's dear friend and a dear friend of Mr. Bob Gimlin. Both of those guys are on the show, including a good friend of ours, which we just saw last week, but he's a little under the weather. He's not feeling well. His name is, you may have heard of him in the past. If not, you're going to hear about him in the future. Philip Morrison, that's not the cigarette. Man, he's the man that sold the costume to Roger Patterson, ladies and gentlemen. And, of course, our newfound friend and a co-author or an author, just like Greg Long, who wrote Sasquatch for Sale, Mr. Michael Green. And the culmination and put the icing on the cake, ladies and gentlemen, we also have a guy named Leroy Blevins. You may have heard of him. He assisted on the Zapruder film, tearing it apart, that there was more than one shooter. And the arc of the something or another, I forget what it was called. But nevertheless, and also did the expose on the Patty film, which will blow your mind. So we've got an expanded 2-hour show tonight. I want to let everybody know that the news feeds to this show, and it's been out to everybody, I understand it's in excess of 5,000 around the globe, but these are some that are confirmed. California, this is just in the United States. California, Ohio, Maryland, Kansas, Texas, Arizona, Washington, Mississippi, Utah, Nebraska, Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Indiana, Massachusetts, Michigan, Missouri, Tennessee, Nevada, New Jersey, and New Mexico in the states right now that have confirmed that are either recording this show, listening to the show, or have put this out in their marketplaces. Around the globe that have confirmed has been Norway, Oslo County, France, United Kingdom, England, Canada, Ontario, and Saskatchewan. Some of the big affiliates was ABC, CBS, NBC, Fox, CNN, the Bloomberg Report, etc., 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 collectively around the globe tonight, ladies and gentlemen. There are millions and millions of people listening to what's going on this show tonight. And thanks to my beautiful, beautiful, and close friends in the Bigfoot world, this is the reason why we're doing this. We're finally saying we can't take it anymore. We're not going to take it anymore. We're tired of being bashed. We're tired of being called all kinds of names. We're tired of that kid in the class that's the brain passing with getting A's all the time, and the bullies are out there saying, hey, you know, you're nothing but a nerd. You're this. You're nothing but that. But we're out there just telling the truth. What we're going to do tonight, ladies and gentlemen, this is going to be one of many shows until we finally get to the end of this thing where these people come forth and say, hey, okay, we don't want to be bashed like we've bashed you. We're going to come out and tell the truth. And towards the end of the show, there's going to be made a challenge to some of these people that are still alive, and we're going to see if they accept that challenge. So, without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to go up there to Washington, talk to my good friend, the man that put a lot of time, his own money, and work into The Making of Bigfoot, the Inside Story of the Roger Patterson Film. Mr. Greg Long. Greg, are you out there?
Yes, I am.
How are you this evening?
I'm very well, thank you.
Well, I guess you know. You and I and our other fellow colleagues on this project, I don't know if you've gotten bashed yet today, but I understand that we've got somewhere around 1,600 texts and emails saying we're this, we're that, and everything else, and the Patty film is the greatest and realest thing in the world. But, you know, by us collectively, we are going to tell the truth and let everybody know around the globe, starting tonight, how this whole thing came about and who the culprits were, who the people that deceived all of us in mainstream America, and who those people got onto this money train and has been riding it for almost 50 years come next year. So what I'm going to do until our first break, Greg, I want you to tell everybody how you got into this whole deal and how you went through the making of that entire book and how long it took you and what you had, all the
money you got. I've had a long-time interest in, paranormal subjects, not just Bigfoot, but, unidentified flying objects, spirits or ghosts or what have you. I mean, there's a whole range of paranormal topics that we could all talk about. I'm sure we all have had interest in them one time or another. But I was transferred up to this state of Washington from my job in Oregon and realized that there was Yakima, Washington was only about 2.5-hour drive from my home where I had relocated to. And I had been going out to the Yakima Indian Reservation to talk to fire lookouts there who saw strange objects in the sky. That's a totally a different story. But in doing so, Roger Patterson's name would come up among the residents there. And I had heard of Roger Patterson, of course, the film, having seen it on television for many years. And was curious about the film and also the man behind it, Roger Patterson. By talking to some residents there, I was given some names of people who were very open to talking about Roger, who he was, his character. And suddenly I found myself inundated with so much evidence, so many stories from so many people in that community that I eventually discovered the man who wore this Bigfoot costume, and that's, of course, Bob Hieronymus. I ended up doing over 40 interviews. Almost all were audiotaped in these individuals' homes, some, of course, by phone. Did research in newspaper files. I looked into criminal records, the background of Patterson himself, the background of Bob Gimlin, Bob Hieronymus, Al DiAtley, of course, who it was Roger Patterson's brother-in-law who funded Roger's expeditions, as he called them, to look for Bigfoot. And a story finally fell into place, which absolutely shocked me, that this film was simply a hoax. It was planned and organized by a small group of people. Bob Hieronymus, having been and still is a tall man, a very husky and well-built young man at the time, was invited to wear a Bigfoot costume. He, in fact, put it on there in the back of Roger Patterson's house. Patty Patterson, Roger's wife, actually was standing at the kitchen window and looked at Bob Hieronymus put it on. And so many facts came out about this case that it was quite obvious that it was carefully planned out by a man, Roger Patterson, who actually was chronically unemployed and had a history of conning people. Even Rene DeHinden, who is no longer with us, who is a famous Bigfoot researcher himself and ultimately made money off of Patterson's film, told me in an interview that Patterson was a crook, but that we should ignore the fact that he was a crook and look at the film only. And that was really the evidence, was the film and not the man behind it. But for me, I don't like lies. I don't like liars. I like honesty. I like forthrightness, and I like facts. And so I've concluded after all those many interviews and 4 years of research and writing that it indeed is a hoax. And that's how it all came about. Initially, my being close to Yakima, my ability to get over there quickly and simply dig into the stories, and that's how it all came about.
Okay, so by saying that, how the whole thing came about, why don't you go into the part of who you went to talk to first and how it evolved then when you found out that, oh my gosh, there was people actually funding this thing. Oh my gosh, the brother-in-law had something to do with this. And oh, by the way, it wasn't really, this whole movie was not shot the date that they all said it was, in October of 1967. And during this whole time, there was some criminal problems going on. I understand that he never returned a camera. He owed people money. There was warrants out for his arrest. Why don't you take it from there?
Sure. The way that I got onto the story was I was actually interviewing a man who had some sightings of UFOs. He claimed they were UFO sightings, and I wanted to know about that. And Roger Patterson's name came up. I don't recall the exact. I think we were having breakfast, and his name came up. And I said, well, did you know Roger Patterson? What can you tell me about him? He said, well, there's one man you ought to talk to. His name is Les Johnson. Les Johnson, who lives up the road a piece, he'll talk to you about Roger Patterson. Well, it was several months later that I had the opportunity to go back to Yakima, and I had found Les Johnson's phone number, and I phoned him, and I said, apparently you know something about Patterson. He said, oh, yeah, I know all about Roger Patterson, and I can even tell you who wore the Bigfoot suit. And, of course, I was floored and shocked by hearing this, and I said, I'll be right out. So I went out to see him there in Tampico, which is west of Yakima. It's a small community, and that's where Roger Patterson had lived much of his adult life. And I interviewed Les Johnson, who gave me more names, and these names became leads, and I began interviewing more and more people. It would take me hours to tell you the exact sequence of who I interviewed first, second, and third. But it didn't take long, in fact, in this first interview, to find out the name of Bob Hieronymus. I approached Bob Hieronymus without warning one day on the weekend, and he came to the door. I'm sure he can tell you about this. And he was holding, I believe, a granddaughter, and he seemed like a very normal individual. He was tall and, as I said, well-built. And I told him, I understand that you are the guy who wore this Bigfoot suit. Well, he sort of stammered around that and said, well, I don't know what you're talking about, and so on and so forth. And I think I'll get myself a lawyer, which right away rang bells in my head. There's something going on here. I finally contacted his lawyer. I found out his lawyer was, after a second phone interview, or rather the first phone interview with Bob Hieronymus, and found out he did have a lawyer. I contacted the lawyer. He was not going to reveal the information to me, but said that this involves some well-known people in the community. That, and that's more than Bob Hieronymus, okay? And I thought, well-known people. Well, if you take a look at some of the literature that's been published decades ago, Al DiAtley is a very wealthy businessman who founded a company called Superior Asphalt, and has made millions and millions of dollars in paving roads in Washington and also other parts of the Southwest. And if you find that literature, you'll find that he was funding Roger Patterson in making these expeditions. So I now had a name of someone who may know about this story as well. Of course, Patty Patterson's name had come up in conversations with Les Johnson, and I approached her. She allowed me to go into her home. At that time, my wife was with me, Pat, and we sat down, and I told her there's a name of a man who wore the Bigfoot suit, and I gave her the name, and she hemmed and hawed, and, well, I don't think I've ever heard of that person before. I don't know who you're talking about. I showed her a photograph which shows Bob Hieronymus, Roger Patterson, and numbers of other cowboys on horseback who were participating in making a movie with Roger Patterson, which was basically about hunting for Bigfoot. And I showed her Bob Hieronymus' picture, and she said, I don't really know who that is. Well, that's surprised me because Tampico, Washington is a very small community. I'm not going to tell you the population. I don't know. It's probably no more than several hundred people at the time. And it would be virtually impossible for her not to know Bob Hieronymus, especially since he put on the Bigfoot suit in the backyard of her home. But she was a very ungracious woman and gave me no information, refused to be interviewed. And so I knew I was not going to get very far with her. I then attempted to interview Bob Gimlin, because his name, of course, is associated with his filming. And he refused to be interviewed at all. His wife protects him from the press. She's very, very jealous of people actually interviewing him. Bob Gimlin, of course, is now the sort of the hero of this whole story. He's the darling of the current generation of big hunters because he can go and tell his fish story. You know, I'm saying big fish story because the Bigfoot that he saw was originally 6 foot one, and over the years it grew to be 6 foot 4 inches tall, by the way. So he has his famous fish story. But he's protected very well by his fans and his groupies and newbies. But that's kind of basically how it took off. Was through Les Johnson. It led me to Hieronymus rather quickly. It led me to a lawyer, and I continued my interviewing and finally approached Bob again. And by this time, Bob knew that I was interviewing countless people in the Yakima Valley area, and he finally met with me. And with a friend as well, and he told me that he wore the suit, and he agreed to a taped interview. We met him in our motel room. Pat and I had a motel there in Yakima, and he came in with his wife, and let me tape his confession, if you will. And he mentioned, in fact, other people involved in this, Aldi Attlee and Patty Patterson.
Okay, so you brought us up.
And I could go on, but I think you have some time limitations.
No, well, we do, but I really put some time for you because, you know, this book of yours, The Making of Bigfoot, the behind the story of the Patterson film, is just, as far as I'm concerned, remarkable. And I want the people out there to know what you've done is stupendous. Okay, and you had the guts and courage to come forward, and throughout the years now since your book has been published, you've been through hell, to say the least. You know,
The immediate reaction was that I'm a liar, and of course the same was launched on Bob Hieronymus. Not only was he called a liar, but called a drunk. And the reason why they called him a drunk is that Bob Hieronymus likes to have a beer or two at a local tavern. I know him. He's not an alcoholic, and he's not a drunk. But they smeared him upside and down. Matt Moneymaker is a name of a person who has a site. I don't recall the name of it, Bigfoot Forums or whatever. And I managed to join that forum and watch the insults pour in on an hourly basis. People filled with anger and outright hatred of me and this story and Bob Hieronymus. And it began to reveal to me an unfortunate, sordid, dark side of Bigfootology, if you will. There are many people in the field that I think have an inability to use common sense and reasoning powers and live in a world of fantasy and emotional confusion, if you will. They've taken the subject of Bigfoot to the point of a religious belief, a blind religious belief, and tied that religion to this 1/60-second hoax film. And they cling to that and hold that close to themselves. as being the proof and evidence of the existence of Bigfoot. And by the way, let me point out, I don't disbelieve in the existence of Bigfoot. There's too many stories of Bigfoot, I mean good witness accounts of Bigfoot, that this creature may truly exist. How it has managed to elude capture and killing, I can't explain that. He apparently is an extremely intelligent creature. But so it's not that I have any problem with the Bigfoot creature per se. My experience with them and their reaction to my book was, this is a very sorry, sad group of people who refused to read the book outright or just simply smeared it and said it's all lies. To my knowledge, none of them have ever followed up on any of the witnesses that I interviewed, and certainly no one ever visited me to talk to me personally about my research. And that's what happened to me, is I was torn apart. Luckily, I had some news stories put out. I had some people who visited me and interviewed me and did a good job in hearing me speak the truth to them. But overall, the Bigfoot community hates the book, hates Hieronymus, hates anyone associated. And I probably include you, Tom. You're probably on that list of those who are now hated.
I love it. But here's the thing I want to point out to my listeners around the globe, if you would, Greg. Because the day you told me this, and ladies and gentlemen, you can go to Bigfoot Live and BigfootLiveRadio.com, and you can see what he looks like, he and I together. If you just go there on the icon on top where it says Hoax of the Century, and you'll see Greg and myself. And next to us, you'll see the Bob Hieronymus garage, in which he has this big picture stating Bigfoot lives here, and it's a picture of the Patty, due to the fact that he only lives a few houses down the street from Bob Gimlin, for those of you who don't know, which we'll get into this. And he has, Bob Gimlin supposedly has this yellow sign that says something about Bigfoot crossing, and Bob himself, Hieronymus, will talk about that coming up pretty soon. But here's what I want you to bring out, Greg. It blew my mind when you told me nobody, when this footage broke and went worldwide and went crazy, nobody really in the media or in the industry really went up to Yakima and went to see the neighbors or talk to the neighbors or that city and said, hey, what is this guy like? And, oh, by the way, is there such a Bigfoot? Your response to me was, are you serious? Everybody knew it was Bob Hieronymus, and it was a hoax. It was a joke. Do you remember telling me that?
Yeah, I know. It was a shock to me that no one would have gone out and interviewed Patterson. I don't know specifically whether he was never interviewed in his hometown there in Tampa, Yakima, but I could find no evidence in my researches through newspaper files that any serious member of the media ever went out and talked to him and could have probed into his claims and could have done the same thing I would have done and would have exposed the truth early on. So they were completely irresponsible about it. I think they now view Bigfoot as a big joke. It's either a joke or it's a source of entertainment and revenues. It's big business for some members of the entertainment industry. So it's really been a dereliction of duty by journalists. And unfortunately, journalists today are probably, I hate to say it, less journalists than they used to be many years ago. If you ever look at some of the polls that are taken about the public's perception of journalists, it's rather low. No journalist job was done. I was shocked. As you were as well, just shocked that if they just hunted around and poked around, they would have gotten Bob Hieronymus' name. This may have been proven to be a hoax early on, but it was raised to the level of an icon in the field, and it became a massive money-making operation. Al Diatley claimed in an interview to me that he had himself made $200,000 on it, which is considerably in 1967-68. I do recall interviewing a witness who saw Patterson driving around in a black Cadillac at one point. And Bob Gimlin made money. But by the way, Bob Gimlin was cut out of proceeds from the film because he was not allowed by his wife, as I understand it, to go on the road to promote the film, which Al Diatley and Roger Patterson did. They took the film out on the road and using what's called four-walling techniques. It's a technique used where you do massive advertising in a city or a town, generate big audiences to come into the theater, show the film over one or two nights, and then leave town and go to the next one. Massive advertising, huge audiences, and move quickly across the country. And that's what Al Diatley and Roger Patterson did. They went across the country and finally up into Minnesota. And Minnesota was the last real venue for showing the film because there was a hoax of the, I think it's called the Minnesota Iceman, was exposed as a hoax in Minnesota, and the public got turned off and felt, why watch this other claim of a Bigfoot walking through a dry creek bed in Northern California. That is, you know, Patterson's film. But a lot of money was made off it initially. And, of course, Patterson ended up writing contracts behind other people's backs. In other words, he would write multiple contracts for exclusive rights to more than one television production company or independent production company and make money that way. And in the process, made a lot of enemies. When he died, the film was passed on to Patty Patterson and Renee DeHinden, who wanted to make money out of it. John Green, the famous John Green, made money out of it. And there was ultimately a big fight over who had the rights to the film, because Bob Gimlin couldn't take the fact that he didn't get any money and he sold his portion to Renee DeHinden for a dollar. Over a cup of coffee in a local coffee shop. So since then, Patty Patterson has reaped massive benefits from it. I don't know exactly how much money she's made, but she, my understanding is she's retained an attorney, and if she gets a request for a production company to use rights to it, she has them contact her lawyer, and then the film is provided in a particular format to the buyer, and they go ahead and use it for their own purposes. She's made a lot of money. I can't even tell you how much, but she's pretty much lived off the film as far as I can tell. It still does.
Let me ask you this, Greg. To your all your determination of going through all of the fact-finding information that you've gone through and all the people you've interviewed, tell me when you came across his record. I'm talking about record of with the police and stolen goods and stuff like that. What went through your head?
Well, I immediately felt that he was, you know, he was obviously dishonest. I mean, you mentioned the camera. He did rent a camera from a local camera shop, and he never returned it. The camera shop owner made all the efforts he could to get the camera back, and Patterson refused to return it, so he was finally arrested by the Yakima County Sheriff and hauled into court. Ultimately, the charges were dropped. I don't know why. Perhaps it was just not worth dealing with this camera issue. The camera, I don't know what happened to the camera. Peter Byrne, who was at that time interested in the film, and he may be familiar to some of your audience members, and he's now in, he lives in Nepal, dealing with conservation matters. He was interested in the film. He tried to track down what happened to the film and feels that perhaps Patterson had sold it. So who knows what happened to the film, but the owner never got his camera back. So that was kind of a red flag for me. I mean, can't this guy just return a camera? I mean, what's the point here? What's he trying to do? But that led to me getting files that showed he was delinquent always on paying bills. He never had enough money to pay even grocery bills. So creditors were constantly out after him, and I list all that in my book, The Making of Bigfoot. Creditors were always after him. Renee DeHinden told me himself that Patterson would started a sort of a Bigfoot club, and he would sell a book that he himself wrote. And DeHinden said that Patterson would receive checks for the book, but Patterson decided he wasn't going to send the book to them. So basically, he was committing mail fraud. But no, he didn't really want to work for a living. He made that note early on. He worked in a couple of jobs, like he was a roofer for a while, and then he stopped doing that. And then he worked in an auto parts store for a while and stayed a couple of hours and quit and told one of his brothers, I'm never going to work for anyone again. So he basically lived off other people is what he did. And he also lived off of Patty Patterson's father. Patterson didn't live that far away. He and his wife Patty in the Tampico area, and Patty Patterson's father realized that unfortunately his son-in-law was sort of a bum. So he would buy groceries for them and help them and get along. And in fact, they couldn't even afford a house or any place. So he let them stay in one of his homes. He had more than one home. So Patterson wandered around and basically promoted Bigfoot in the community and got a little following of various people, which I name in the book, and they would follow him around and support him and believe in him. And he went up and saw John Green at one point and got clippings from John Green, and he used those to create his book that he wrote, and he illustrated his book. He was a cartoonist, and so he had an artistic skill to what he did. And he was a pretty creative, thoughtful guy. You know, he had a lot of time on his hands, and he did interview Bigfoot, you know, witnesses, I know that. And I think from all of his creativity and his time on his hands and the fact that he didn't want to work for a living, he conceived of this hoax. And my book does have some reference to how he did approach a camera store owner to get a motion picture camera that he could use because he claimed that Bigfoot was appearing behind his house out there in Tampico, and then made reference to the fact that that he wanted to use the motion picture camera because he was having an ape suit shipped to him by bus from Los Angeles. And that's in my book. So he did a lot of, I think, preliminary hoaxing and testing out of cameras and how this whole thing would work. He put his book together, and he sold that to make money. He attempted to have Hollywood make a film about Bigfoot in general, and Al DiAtle went with him down to Hollywood, and they tried to generate interest there, but no one would buy his idea. And so finally what he decided to do is he'll make his own movie, and as I mentioned earlier, there's a photograph that shows Bob Hieronymus and Roger Patterson and others named in the book who all were these sort of amateur actors on horseback that he had ride their horses behind his home, and they're in Tampico, and film them searching for Bigfoot. All he needed then was the Bigfoot itself, and that's where Bob Gimlin approached Bob Hieronymus in place of Roger and said, you want to make $1,000, we just need to have you wear a costume. And so Bob Hieronymus, being interested in money, said, hey, why not? I don't think Bob Hieronymus, and he can talk to this better than me, ever thought that he would be involved in producing a movie that would later be used to promote a massive money-making lie on the American public. He was simply a guy who was a little naive at the time and was interested in making some quick money, and so that's what he did.
$1,000 back in 1967 was a lot of money. I mean, what was it? $1.25 an hour people were getting paid?
Yep. And by the way, let me just quickly let you know that I looked into Bob Hieronymus' past. I wanted to find out if he had any criminal record. By the way, Bob Gimlin actually did. He was accused by the authorities there in Yakima of accepting stolen material from several people who were indicted, which included Bob Gimlin. I don't know the disposition of the case, but there was something a little little shady there about Bob Gemlin. But I looked into Bob Hieronymus's past. I thought there's no criminal record on him whatsoever. I talked to his former employers because he managed the several ranches there in Yakima before he finally became an employee with the Pepsi Cola, local Pepsi Cola distributing plant there in Yakima. And they came up clean. There was nothing on him that's suggested to me that he had ever participated in any criminal activity at all. And he also passed two lie detector exams, by the way, when this story began to broke. One was given by a Yakima County deputy sheriff, and then also he was given a lie detector exam on a show called Lie Detector, in which he passed that exam as well. So anyway, he became a participant and never got a dime for it. But the guys who raked in the money were Aldi Attlee, Patterson, Gimlin to an extent, and then, of course, Patterson's widow, Patty Patterson, Renee DeHinden as well. Okay. And I'm sure if this movie it continues to be accepted as the lie that it is, it'll continue to make money by Patty Patterson's heirs, who will be given the film. They'll go out and promote it. It could live on for thousands of years, couldn't it, unless it were completely and finally exposes the lie that it is.
And that's what we're trying to do now. There was one other point I wanted you to make, and that's about one of them that's in our movie, Hoax of the Century, and you were so kind to give us that footage that you had taken by the woman who's deceased today. Do you know who I'm talking about?
Yes, Vilma Raftard, yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Before you get into that, we'll do that on the other side of commercial. Bill, let's go to commercial and pay some bills, good buddy.
Okay.
I got here, but now I can't get into this.
1967, my whole life changed. I saw the Roger Patterson film on the Johnny Carson show. And I gotta tell you, that's the day I thought I was gonna challenge the world and go out and find this thing.
We had found like 12 tracks in the ground. I didn't want to believe it was Bigfoot.
There he is.
Did you hear that?
He's moving right now. He's moving right now. He's straight out of the tree line. He's moving to the right. See him? He's going to the right. He's going into the trees right now. Come here, look.
I'm Bob Hallmark, and I'm a reporter with ABC Television in Tyler, Longview. It's been my pleasure to be with Tom Scotty and his team tonight, and I have to admit that I was skeptical when I came out here. I thought we, at this time in our history, had the technology to be able to find one of these things, if it existed. But after seeing the footprints and the dig marks in the sand, and what I believe to be a very large creature running at a high rate of speed through the woods, I'm convinced I'm going to have to change my opinion on Bigfoot.
I turned, I saw this thing standing by my gator.
When I saw the actual footprints, I realized they were something special and probably Sasquatch.
Like landed on the ground, I'm kind of thinking, this ain't no human being. It's got to be something else.
www.searchingforbigfoot.com.
And we're back, Tom.
You know, ladies and gentlemen, I got to tell you, it gives me shivers down my back, and the hair goes up on my neck when I hear that little ditty. And then, wouldn't you know it, this stupid film was the film that got me into this industry, and countless others, I don't know, thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands around the globe. And here we are talking about it today and found out how we've all been duped, how we've all been deceived. The deceit is just unmentionable. And some of the characters who portrayed in this movie, who made this movie. They're icons today, as you know, Greg put it. I'm just, and then there's one poor guy, which we're going to talk to next, that got trampled and thrown into the mud. But before that, we do any going back to talk to Greg on some of those investors. I want to put a big shout out to a good buddy of mine, Stephen Pelizzeri. Ladies and gentlemen, any of you people out there in the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, you probably heard of him. He's been in business from 1908 from his daddy, Atlas Pelizzeri Electric, one of the finest contractors, electrical contractors in the state of California. So you never need any work, you call Atlas Pelizzeri Electric, ladies and gentlemen. They're fine, fine people. All right, without any further ado, let's get back out to Greg in Washington. How are you, Greg? I thank you for spending us the time the way you're doing, and you're doing a marvelous, phenomenal job. Let everybody know about some of those people, like that woman that's in our film, Hoax of the Century.
Yeah. Yeah, let's talk about her. Her name was Vilma Radford. Not Wilma, but Vilma, V-I-L-M-A. Radford, R-A-D-F-O-R-D. Vilma Radford, I did not know she existed until I stumbled across a news clipping. My wife and I were at the University of Washington going through the Yakima newspaper. Here was a little story about Vilma Radford. It dealt with Vilma Radford suing Roger Patterson. And I thought, well, what's going on here? Well, it turns out that Roger Patterson, fast-talking Roger Patterson, this was after his book came out. So this would have been late 66, the fall of 66, or into winter or spring of 67. This was, of course, his film was shot in October of 1967.
Allegedly,
yeah, that's the date that we're given. But I read this article, and I thought, well, he's being sued. Why? Well, it turns out by my digging through files and finally reaching her that Patterson had signed, she had signed a contract with Roger Patterson that he was going to borrow money from her and use the money to search for Bigfoot and make a film called Do Abominable Snowmen of America Exist? Which, by the way, is the title of his book that came out in the fall of 66. So he came over and did quite a piece of showmanship in pitching this entire idea that Bigfoot existed, and I believe he had Bigfoot cast with him and his book and so on and so forth. And he wanted to see if he could borrow some money from her. He had found out through Jerry Lee Merritt, who's another character in all of this. He's a rockabilly star who died a number of years ago, but he lived in Yakima. And Patterson knew him. Jerry Lee Merritt had found out that Vilma Radford had been in a severe car accident and had a settlement. So Patterson figured, if I can get my hands on this settlement, I'll need the money. I'll have the money that I need to go down to California and make this film and pay for my expenses. So she did loan him the money, and he never paid it back. When she found out that this film came out, his 60-second clip, she found a lawyer and attempted to sue him. And it never went anywhere because Patterson never had any money. He either got it short-term and spent it all through whatever means he could find it. And so she finally went out to his house there in Tampico and gained entrance into it and went in there and said, I want my money. And he was just sitting there, and he looked at her and said, well, you ain't going to get your money because there isn't any money. And she couldn't do anything about it. So she eventually just dropped the lawsuit. But she was a very astute woman because she kept all of the files and notes and everything related to Patterson and clipped these things out of the newspaper in Yakima and had a considerable amount of information to show me. I met her several times and interviewed her personally, and also videotaped her, which portion of that is in the DVD you have produced called The World's Greatest Hoax. and I think, you know, obviously you studied it as well, is she never forgot it. She never forgot how she was scammed by Patterson. And I'm just very grateful that she spoke to me and was able to tell me her story. She kept repeating over and over again, I don't like people who lie. I just don't like people who lie. And so she did a great thing as far as providing very strong evidence of one of his scams. But as I said, Patterson just didn't want to work for a living. And we have a lot of those people today, perhaps, in the United States. I don't want to get into all of that. But sure, it would be comfortable not to work for a living, wouldn't it, Tom?
I want to add something to this. Because I remember Patty Patterson telling me when I was there to see her, and I remember you telling me also through your investigative interviews with so many people, this guy was pretty artistic because he had all his time on his hands. And I remember Philip Morris telling me the story about he was creative enough to add the pendulous breasts. He had told him about cutting the eyes around the suit and shaving some of the hair and all that stuff.
Right.
She
right.
also added the shoulder pads from the high school that he obtained in the area. I mean, he was pretty astute to doing this because there were sculptures that he had made.
That's right. He sculpted the head of Bigfoot.
Yes.
Looked a little bit more like a Neanderthal head. But he worked in leather. He worked in a carving. But he was a good tool. You know, used tools for making leather objects and such. He was artistic. He was an illustrator. He sold some of his paintings to several people in the Methow Valley area, I understand. And I saw his paintings in the home of one of his brothers when I interviewed one of his brothers. I would say his perception of anatomy was not always totally correct, or his use of perspective, but he did a pretty good job, you know, on painting and illustrating horses and cowboys on horseback and sort of Western themes. So, yeah, he was definitely creative, and he was drawing when he was a kid. His older brother told me that he took up cartooning and illustrating when he was in his teenage years. So, yeah, he was very perceptive. And so when he got the gorilla suit from Philip Morris, he knew he had to expand the shoulders. So he got football pads, football player pads to put inside the suit. The pendulous breasts, I'm convinced, came from, there's a famous story, and I hate to even say it was Albert Ostman, because I may be getting that right for those historians out there. But there was a story about a Canadian who went hiking up in a mountain, and he came across a Bigfoot that was crouched down drinking water from a creek, which, by the way, is what Patterson said he saw when he and Gimlin came around a huge uprooted stump of a tree. There was this hairy figure squatted down at this in this very dry creek bed. But anyway, this particular Canadian saw Bigfoot, and it got up and walked away, and he could see that it had breasts. It was amazing. It had breasts, you know. And it walked away into the woods, kind of like Patterson's film, you know, the creature stands up and just walks away. But I think that's where he got the idea of the pendulous breasts. It also throws in an element that is so odd and strange that it makes it seem like it's real, you know, because if you have a male Bigfoot, I guess you might as well have a female Bigfoot, right? So why not have something like that that really gets your attention? But no, he, according to Morris, of course, he modified the suit in various ways, and you can tell if you look at the feet of that Bigfoot costume, they kind of look like slippers, you know, they just don't look like real feet. They look like pads of some sort, the artificial latex feet of some sort. But, you know, and Hieronymus could tell you about the eye. If you take a look at the Bigfoot frame, one of the Bigfoot frames, I call it the look where the Bigfoot looks at you, he looks at the camera. You blow that up and you can see there's an eye there that looks like it's reflecting light. And that turns out to be...
No more.
Okay.
let's leave that for Bob.
Let's leave that as a teaser.
Yes. So here's what I want you to do. I just want you to mute yourself out, or Marco Bill will, and then we're going to do one more commercial. On the backside of the commercial, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to bring out the man himself, Mr. who wore the suit. Let's go to commercial.
Mm-hmm. 1967, my whole life changed. I saw the Roger Patterson film on the Johnny Carson show. And I gotta tell you, that's the day I thought I was gonna challenge the world and go out and find this thing.
We had found like 12 tracks on the ground. I didn't want to believe it was Bigfoot.
There he is.
Did you hear that?
He's moving right now. He's moving right now. He's straight out of the tree line. He's moving to the right. See him? He's going to the right. He's going into the trees right now. Come here, look.
I'm Bob Hallmark, and I'm a reporter with ABC Television in Tyler, Longview. It's been my pleasure to be with Tom Scotty and his team tonight, and I have to admit that I was skeptical. When I came out here, I thought we, at this time in our history, had the technology to be able to find one of these things if it existed. But after seeing the footprints and the dig marks in the sand and what I believe to be a very large creature running at a high rate of speed through the woods, I'm convinced I'm going to have to change my opinion on Bigfoot.
I turned, I saw this thing standing by my gator.
When I saw the actual footprints, I realized they were something special and probably Sasquatch.
Like landed on the ground, I kind of thinking, this ain't no human being. It's got to be something else.
www.searchingforbigfoot.com.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we're back. I want to denote something right now. It's a sin that so many of us have been duped because of this footage. Got me into the industry and so many others around the globe, I'm sure. I want the people to know out there in Bigfoot world, in the Bigfoot world and around the globe, that there is such a creature that lives. There is this unknown primate roaming our countries out in rural lands that are migrating north to south, south to north, depending on the time of the year. I know I've had 7 encounters in over 45 years, okay? So I started off, like everybody else in this industry, to debunk this thing, and then I got bit because I saw my first one. I always thought there was something wrong because it never looked like the one that Roger Patterson took. Then as we're roaming around the countryside, I'm in Texas, I'm in Louisiana, and they even looked even different than the ones we saw in Texas or the ones we saw in Montana. And I says to myself, my God, or the ones in California, you know, what is this? You know, and then, of course, everybody thinks there's only one Bigfoot, ladies and gentlemen. There's around 8,000 of them in North America alone, just known by different names, and other countries around the globe known by different names, okay? But I want everybody out there, I don't want them to think that we're trying to say there are no Bigfoot in this, in the countries, in the world. Because there are. There is an unknown primate roaming these countries around the globe that we are not aware of. We have not captured one. We have not. Nobody has got a dead body yet. A lot of people have had sightings. And a lot of people know that these things do exist. I'm having problems, though, with a lot of our scholastic people in the world, i.e. our teachers, our scholastic PhDs, our so-called PhDs that are in anthropology and history and say that they got behind the Patterson film and say, oh, man, this is the real deal. Are you serious? Really? Come on now. Let's be real. So I'm not going to say anything more about that on this show, but I'm just really ticked because these are the people, ladies and gentlemen, that are teaching our kids, our grandchildren, okay? I'm saying, oh, well, this Patterson film, look at it, it's a real deal. Well, these are the kind of people that need to go back to school and get re-educated, and hopefully we are the people that are going to do it. Ladies and gentlemen, you just got through hearing Greg Long. This man is a roaming and walking cornucopia of knowledge when it comes to this guy, Roger Patterson, and the crew and this film. He's just one major part. The other guy that he's still alive today, I have all the respect in the world for him, and he's taken a lot of flack. Without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, let's go up to Yakima, Washington, the man that lives just a few doors down from Bob Gimlin, Mr. Bob Hieronymus. Bob, you out there?
Yes, I'm out here.
How are you this evening, good buddy?
Very good, thank you.
Well, I got to tell you, number one, thank you for being here with us. Number two, I am so sorry for what you've gone through, but you know what? I've been right there in the gutters with you because I've been tooting that flute, and I've been hearing that song constantly from these people, these haters, these bashers, and they're just disillusioned, Bob. That's the only thing I can come up with.
Yes.
But we're
going to
get
some
kind of
restitution. They think,
I assure you of that. So what I'd like for you to do, Bob, if you would, tell us the story on how Patterson or Gimlin came to you and asked you to wear this suit, and what they asked you to do, how the whole thing came to play. Would you be kind enough to do that?
Sure. I'll tell you exactly how it happened. I ran around with Bob Gimlin for a while there. We broke a few horses and rode in the mountains quite a bit and chased a few cows. And, him and Roger were good buddies. So Roger came up with this idea, you know, about this Bigfoot thing. And, of course, Philip Morris sent him the suit. Well, Bob came to me one day and said, we're looking for a strong guy, you know, that could wear this suit, he said, and not, you know, tell anybody. So he said, if you'd come up there and put the suit on, you know, and go to California and do the film, we'll give you $1,000. Well, I said, that's, you know, I was 26 years old, single, and, you know, $1,000 for a 10-minute film or whatever it was. Sure, I'd do that. So I went up to Roger's place up there on the South Fork of Tampico and tried the suit on, and he showed me how he wanted me to walk. Well, everybody says I walk that way anyway, so it was no problem, you know. And he said, that's just exactly the way I want it. So a while later, they came by. They were heading for California. They came by and picked up one of my horses and took off for California, and they said, well, meet us down there, like this is on a Sunday, meet us down there on a Wednesday at a gas station there in the little town there, and at 5 o'clock. So I took off out of here, you know, it's about a 14-hour drive down there, and I pulled in there exactly, you know, at 5 o'clock, and Bob or Roger, I think it was Bob, come over to the car and said, there's a pull-off down the road here ways. He said, go down there and wait for us. We don't want to have people seeing me talk to you, you know, or the three of us together. So I took off, went down the road there, and then pretty soon here they came. And like I say, we went up the Bluff Creek there. Wasn't very far. I had a car, so the road wasn't really, really bad. So we got up there where they had a camp set up, and pulled off the road there and hid the car in a bunch of buck brush. We piled a brush around it, you know, so that nobody would see it from the road. And we went to sleep there, and the next morning we got up and saddled the horses and put the suit was in a gunny, big gunny sack. So Roger carried it behind his horse, and I jumped on behind Bob and my horse, and we rode up, I don't know, half a mile or whatever. And this is a place they had picked out when they first got there. And so they helped me put the suit on, and Roger said, okay, go over to this by this tree over here. And he said, when I tell you to start walking, do your walk. Well, he claimed that the horse of my horse was bucking. But my horse didn't know how to buck, but he was jiggling the film up and down. That's why you see it was, you know, jumping up and down. Anyway, he finally stopped, and as I was going by, and we had already determined when I would turn my head and look at him and keep on walking. Well, so I kept on walking through there, and they stopped the film, and there was a big old blowed-off tree, over tree there. And I jumped down in that hole, in that, and it was hot, you know. And I think it was around the end of September, around the 1st of October, in that area. And I was sweating, my God, you know, it was terrible hot. And I was also afraid somebody was going to shoot me, you know, walking down through there. So I yelled, get this son of a bitch off me. And they come running over there and jerked the head of it off and then got me out of it. And we ended up going back to camp, and Roger handed me this envelope with a film in it. He said, take this to Eureka,
Bob,
California.
Before you do that, before you tell the audience about that, let's go back to the time that you were walking before you took the hood off, and before you even came up there, he asked you to do something. I don't want to put words in your mouth, but he says to you, do you still have that thing that was between your – there's two things above your nose there. What do you call those?
Your eyes, man.
Your eyes. There you go. And what did he ask you to do?
I have a prosthesis eye, and I had two or three extra ones, and that was my suggestion. I said, okay, Roger, when I turn to look at you, if you would take one of these eyes and mold it in to the right side, when I turn to look at you, I'll be, this eye will be looking right straight at you. And sure enough, you know, he said, that's a hell of an idea. And he went ahead and put the mold, you know, molded the eye in there. And as you can see on the film in the close up, my right eye is protruding out so you can see it, and the left eye is sunk back in there half inch or inch or whatever is inside.
That's the one that glistens in the sun, right?
That was my prosthesis eye.
Okay, and I'm glad you brought that out to the audience because a lot of people have been asking.
I mean, nobody knew this for a long time. In fact, Greg Long finally wriggled it out of me. You know, I wasn't going to tell anybody. That was my kind of a what you call an ace in the hole. But your scientists and all those guys would take a look at that. That, you know, they think a little bit different.
So, who helped you on with the waders to make the hips and the padding, the pillow in the back by the butt?
I sat down on a log and pushed my feet in, you know, into the suit like, I don't know, you put on a snowmobile suit or something. And then I zipped it up in the back and combed the hair across it, you know, the zipper. And then they put the last part was the head went on.
What about the shoulder pads?
The shoulder pads were no football shoulder pads he got from high school up here. It was some beat up ones. So.
Okay. And what about?
And then, if you really look at the film on my right hip, you'll see a square little thing sitting down there. That was my damn wallet sticking out. Well, you know, these scientists can't figure that out, or you know, so.
Let me ask you this. How did you make the arms look so much longer going down there too?
The arms were longer than my arms because he put a glove inside there, you know, and a stop where when my hand come down to touch them, they were, I don't know, 6, 8, 10 inches longer or whatever it was in my real arms. Those were just extensions on there.
Okay. All right. So now after they stopped filming, and we found out now this film did not get shot. It was either at the end of September or the 1st of October, so it was not shot on the 20th of October, like they said.
They said they were they shot it on the 20th of October, which I don't think it was. But they also said that they showed the film in L.D. Utley's house on October the 20th. How could that be when the film had to go to California to get developed, supposedly, and sent back to Alf?
Now, that's correct. Now, ladies and gentlemen, listen to the time factor here, okay? It don't jive. So who was the one that took that film and put it to the post office to get sent off to get developed?
I don't know. I took the film to Eureka, California, and mailed it to Aldi Atlee.
Okay, that's what I'm talking about. So
and I could have beat
right?
I could have beat it back, you know, the film back, and delivered it before the mail could, really. But
okay,
I
so
guess,
you're
I
the
know.
One after the film was taken. They gave it to you and your trusty hands to go
I took it to Eureka, California, and mailed it to Al. Yes.
That's right. So you went to Eureka, California, to the post office. Is that correct?
Right, right.
And you mailed it to his brother-in-law, Al DeAtley, back
right.
in Washington.
Right.
Okay? And that was supposedly around that time. So it would be, if the timeline was the end of September, ladies and gentlemen, see if you can follow this story, or the 1st of October. Now it's 3 weeks later. Okay? It's the 20th of October. They were watching that in DeAtley's home, and then this big press conference came out. Oh, my God, look what we shot today. Is that correct?
That's correct, but how could it be filmed on the 20th and shown on the 20th at his house?
That's the whole point, and that's what I'm trying to put in perspective to my audience around the globe, and you're doing a very eloquent job. So when that was all done, you where did you go from Eureka, California? Did you go back to Washington?
Yes, I come straight home. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Did he pay you the money?
No, I've never got a dime from him. No. But,
did you question
him
about
a couple
the money
days later?
Said,
they
hey,
showed
when
up.
Are you going to come across with the glue magoo?
Pardon?
Did you ever question Roger or Bob Gimlin and say, hey, when are you going to come across with my money?
Oh yeah, I. Me and another kid that saw the suit in the trunk of the car, I didn't tell anybody what that was. I just said, look at this and don't forget what it looks like. Well, they finally figured out, well, that's where you've been for the last... That's a couple weeks later, they said, that's where you were for 2 or 3 days, huh? Anyway, yeah, Waylon Jennings, you know the Western singer?
Yeah.
Waylon Jennings?
Yeah.
Was having a concert down here in town. Well, we went down there. Me and a bunch of guys from around here, or guys, and Aldi Atlee was there, and we were out there dancing, and the dance was over. I asked Al, I said, hey, Al, when you guys ever going to pay me my $1,000? And he said, that's between you and Roger. And that was the end of the conversation.
Yeah. Okay. That's phenomenal, and thank you for being so honest. Same story you've told me.
Well, you know, when I mailed the film, I come home. Well, a couple of days later, they showed up, brought my horse back. Well, they got in the trunk of the car. Well, it wasn't locked or anything, and the keys were in the car, and nobody locked their car around here in them days. And they took the suit out and dropped my horse off, took the suit out, and that's the last I saw of the suit.
Okay. So let me ask you this. Have you made any money off of the Roger Patterson footage besides the promise of getting $1,000 of wearing the suit, which you never received?
I've never made one dime off that film.
So what do you got to gain by coming out and telling to the world the truth on this film?
Probably nothing, but I just want people to know the truth. That was the biggest
truth. Now, I understand that you took two... lie detector, polygraph test. Is that correct?
Right. I took a lie detector test down at the Yakima Police Department. A lieutenant named Jim McCormick was a lie detector guy down there. And I passed that and never missed anything, you know, not one question. Well, he said guys like us out here don't lie anyway. But And then here, a few years back, I forgot what what year it was, maybe 8, 9, 10 years ago. There was a show on television called Lie Detector. This F. Lee Bailey, the famous attorney.
Yes, yes, yes.
Had that show, and they invited me down there, and I took this Ed Gilb, which was a world famous lie detector guy. He was there. He gave me the lie detector test, and that was again, you know, I didn't miss any, or, you know, everything was true. So I was on that television show, well, one episode of it, yes.
You know, I got to tell you something, Bob. Again, I want to apologize to you for all of the injustice that you've gone through. You know, this whole thing set out to be, I don't know, a game, a joke, a hoax, call it what you want, and it's blown up in people's face, in which it's become an icon in reality in this damn business. And it backfired on a few people. Now, there's this famous picture, and ladies and gentlemen, you can see that if you go to the Hoax of the Century on BigfootLive.com. Now, there's a picture of you on a horse, then the guy that looks like an Indian. Is that Gimlin?
Yes, that was Bob Gimlin. He was with us up there. Typical. We were supposed to be chasing through the woods on horseback, a bunch of us.
Then the one next to Hieronymus looks like it's your brother, Howard.
My brother Howard was there.
Okay, and then there's a guy named Jerry Merritt.
Jerry Merritt. I think he was there, yes.
I've seen him on a horse. And then another guy named John Ballard. And next John
Ballard John was there,
was
yes.
Roger mm-hmm. Patterson.
And Roger, yes.
Yeah, okay, so there was a total of 2, 4, 6 of you.
I think so, yeah, right around there. That was 45, 50 years ago, you know.
That's correct. Here, another guy that comes into play, and the name keeps coming up, is a guy named John Green. You remember that name?
Yeah. He's an asshole as far as I'm concerned.
So he was another one that was intertwined in this, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was, I don't remember exactly how he was into this thing, but him and then DeHind, and there was 3 or 4 of those guys, you know.
I remember it well. You know what, Bob? Maybe we will get some satisfaction after all, and you might want to stay listening to it, because another two people that I got coming on, the guy that actually debunked this film, you're going to like what he's going to say, because it's in your favor, our favor, and that's what the world is going to get to hear. And that's going to come on after our next guest. But I want to thank you and tell Glenda I can't wait to get some of those beautiful, beautiful brownies.
Okay. Thank you for having me on your show.
Oh, she there?
Yes, she's here.
Glenda, I can't wait, darling, to see you. And those brownies of yours are the best in the world. We gotta skip those in the store, girlfriend.
You hear what she said?
What'd she say?
Tom, maybe I can whip up another batch for you.
I can't wait, hon. Listen, Bob, just mute yourself out. You're gonna want to hear the next two stories, okay? We're gonna have a collectively all together at the end.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, buddy. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, that was the man in the suit. Then don't forget about all the bullshit you've heard in the past. That's Bob Hieronymus. If you see the picture, you'll see all of them all together, him, his brother, Gimlin, Jerry Merritt, John Ballard, and, of course, Roger Patterson, the man who was the conductor of this orchestra, along with others that were behind the scene, D'Atley and John Green and a couple of others I can't remember right now myself. My head is just spinning when I see this and I hear this. It's just blowing me away. Now, without any further ado, ladies and gentlemen, the man that sold the suit to Roger Patterson, his name is Philip Morris. He's under the weather, but he's given a good friend of mine, a new friend of mine and ours, a guy named Michael Green, who wrote the book Sasquatch for Sale. We're going to have him do two things. We're going to have him talk about the role that Philip Morris played, number one, and then his own role that he did in his making of his book about the people in the Bigfoot field, and his book's named Sasquatch for Sale. Without any further ado, let's get out there to North Carolina and talk to my newfound friend, my brother, Michael Green. Michael, you out there?
Yes, I am.
How are you this evening?
Just fine, thank you. Just fine.
Okay. Ladies and gentlemen, he is our newfound friend. He's the author of the book, The Sasquatch for Sale. He was with us last week when we were there to see Philip Morris and his lovely bride, Amy, and his family, the son and his daughter, and toured the plant. Why don't you tell everybody how gracious Philip Morris was to us, and when you finally got to meet him, along with my crew that haven't met him yet, and when you walked away, what'd you walk away with?
Well, I walked away with my head spinning for any number of reasons. First off, the guy is incredibly talented. It just talent doesn't even fit here. This guy's an absolute genius when it comes to making costumes, which was a sideline of his back in the 60s when he was a traveling magician. And there was a show that magicians did, a trick, if you will, called The Girl and the Gorilla. And this was sort of a standard trick where a girl would go into a closet and emerge immediately as a gorilla. And then the gorilla would jump out of the closet and run through the crowd, scaring everybody because they didn't expect this to happen. Morris, at the time, realized that the only way that people could get gorilla suits at the time was you had to buy them from overseas, and they cost a lot of money. So being a clever and industrious guy, he and his wife Amy began making gorilla suits to sell to magicians in the United States. And at the time, they were charging $400 or $500 for them. And they advertised, and this is important, they advertised these suits in a magazine, which now, of course, I can't remember the name of, but this magazine was distributed throughout all the circuses and sideshows and theaters and rodeos throughout the United States, advertising. And in Greg Long's book, there's a picture of the page advertising these gorilla suits. Anyway, I want to jump to the to the present for a minute. When I first met Philip Morris, which was, I guess it was last week or the week before, his factory looks like it was built to make B-29s or something. It's one of the biggest buildings I ever saw in my life, and I'm not exaggerating. It's hundreds of yards long, over 1 million square feet. This is the largest costume country in the United States and one of the largest in the whole world. This guy doesn't need money from anybody, believe me. He has made an absolute fortune and is still making it today. He took us in and introduced us to his wife, and we began a tour of the inner part of the factory warehouse, really, where they store these millions of different items. And she took us into the designer's office, where their designer works up various costumes, and you could see they're all over them, and there's hundreds of these things. Every science fiction or horror movie you've ever seen in your entire life, and I'm going way back to Dr. Sardonicus and the Tingler in the late 50s. I mean, way back, right up into Terminator and Alien costumes he made. Absolutely the coolest things I've ever seen in my life. I mean, really, really neat. Anyway, in one corner of one of the rooms was this giant Bigfoot, and the giant Bigfoot was much bigger than the Patterson Gimlin suit. This thing was maybe 9 feet tall. I'm 6 foot five, and I stood next to it, and it towered over me. However, next to it on the table were four or five what I would call Bigfoot sculpture heads in various sort of Neanderthal, monkey, ape, human, different combinations. And then next to that on a chair was an empty, dark brown Bigfoot or gorilla suit. Sitting that next to on a chair next to that was a set of shoulder pads. And Philip Morris pointed and he said, that's a copy of, that was, this here is one of the gorilla suits that I made, and it's exactly the same one that I sold Roger Patterson. And I said, oh, really? You know, can you tell me about this? And he said, yeah. He said, I got a phone call. This is back in August of 1967 from a guy who said he wanted to buy a gorilla suit. And Philip Morris said, I remember asking him, oh, are you a magician? And Patterson told him, no, I'm a, quote, rodeo cowboy. And indeed, Patterson had been doing some rodeo stuff, and that he wanted the film for a joke. So Philip had one of these suits. He and Amy were whipping them up in the basement, and it took them a week or two to make one. And they used a material which you can still get today, apparently, called Dynel, D-Y-N-E-L, which is a sort of a nylon fake hair, which is woven into cloth, and it's used for plush pillows and like toy bears and toilet seats and this sort of stuff. But when you dye it dark brown, it looks like Bigfoot hair or whatever, monster hair, gorilla hair in this case. And he explained to us in lengthy detail how he made the suit. He didn't bother to explain it to Patterson. But Patterson said, well, look, and this is a typical Patterson kind of pattern. Patterson said, well, look, why don't you send me the suit, and if I like it, I'll pay you for it. And if I don't, I'll send it back. And Morris laughed and said, no, I said, why don't you pay me for the suit first, and I'll send it to you. And if you don't like it, send it back, and I'll refund your money. And in retrospect, this sounds so Patterson-ish in his dealings with people. Anyway, Patterson came up with the money. He sent him the suit. And a couple days later, Patterson called him back and he said, listen, the eyes in this thing, there's holes there where the guy who wears the costume's got to look through. And what do I do about that? Because my eyes, skin appears pale in comparison to the darkness of the face. And Morris, who'd been doing this stuff for years, said, well, look, I'm going to send you some black makeup, and you put makeup all around your eyes and your nose and your forehead, and then close your eyelids and have your eyelids painted black, too, so that when you blink, there isn't a flash of white. Just a little detail. So Patterson thanked him, and then called them back another day or two later and said, listen, what can we do about these feet? And I need to bulk it up. And Morris said, well, go down to the football equipment place, get yourself a set of shoulder pads, and that'll bulk up the shoulders really nicely. And I'm going to send you a little, some extra Dynel fur that we've got lying around that you can glue here and there, because Patterson didn't like the face. He said the face looked too gorilla-ish. And Morris, when he saw, and I'm jumping back here a little bit, when Morris first saw the film on TV, the Roger Patterson Gimlin film on TV, he said he started laughing hilariously, and he called to his wife and he said, Amy, come here, look, there's my suit on TV. And Amy came in and said, yeah, and the two of them started roaring with laughter that somebody had pulled this off and that he recognized the suit they made. There were very, very few other people even making these suits in America. You could buy them from overseas, but not in America. Anyway, the issue came down, another issue was, how do I make the arms longer? And if you look at an arm, if you make the hand longer from the elbow down, then when you bend the arm, it's going to look weird because the forearm and the hand are going to be way out of proportion, longer than the upper arm going into the shoulder. However, if you add 4 inches or 5 inches, say, with shoulder pads, and then add 4 or 5 inches of glove to the bottom, then the elbow joint appears to be in proportion, roughly in the middle, and it doesn't look like a suit. It looks like just the way it should, and just the way it does in the film. So there was a long discussion, and he picked up the suit, and he pointed, you know, this is how I did this, and this is where we sewed in the 36-inch zipper in the back. And the zipper they use is, it's, if you've ever had a convertible, and I don't know if the new ones, but the old convertibles had, you zippered in the vinyl rear window, and it was a heavy, heavy-duty zipper, not like you'd get on the fly of your pants, a real heavy-duty zipper. And he said, that's the zipper we used there. And Patterson said, well, look, I can see the zipper, which, of course, is sort of a comic line, and everybody's heard that one before. And Morris said, well, look, you got to take a brush and just, you know, whoever puts the suit on, you take a brush and brush the hair down so that it covers the zipper. Morris said that when Morris did the monkey or gorilla suits in his act, he would brush the hair backwards so that it all stuck up all crazy, more like a sort of an unkempt-looking gorilla. But that Patterson had it all combed down, looking kind of neat, if you will. But it pretty much covered the zipper. Then there was some discussion about the feet, and that Morris said, well, my feet actually were slippers, slipper-like things, because this suit was one size fits all, and the arms, the length of the arm was longer than need be, and so were the length of the legs, because you couldn't make these suits in different sizes. And then you could always cut off the material as you needed if you were shorter. Well, Hieronymus is, I think, 6'1", and he's a bulky guy, and you shove him a couple of shoulder pads in there and a wallet in his right thigh pocket, and things are looking pretty good. But when you get down to the feet, he had to make feet that were big enough to fit everybody, and Philip said, well, my feet were about, the slippers were 14 inches long. That's a big slipper. I've got size 12 feet, and I'm looking, holding my hand up here. And a 14-inch slipper is going to give you a pretty good big footprint. However, the bottom of the slippers was not made to resemble the bottom of a gorilla or Bigfoot foot. And when you look at there's a few frames in the Patterson-Gimlin film where you see the bottom of the feet, and they look flat, and they look more rectangular than foot-like. And I asked him, why didn't you just make them look like a gorilla? And he said, well, the first of all, the gorillas have their big toe sticks way out in front, and it would be very awkward to walk in, and that most gorilla suits were worn by magicians who were working up on a stage so that the audience, who's sitting a little bit below, is looking slightly upwards at the gorilla, and they really, most of the time, they don't even see the gorilla's feet, so it really wasn't important that the bottom of the foot be at all, you know, look like a gorilla. It really didn't matter. So he used these big slippery-like things that you could just shove, anybody could shove their feet in, and if their feet slopped around in them, they would shove paper, tissue paper in the toes until it made for a nice snug fit. Anyway, he showed us this suit, and he's going through these one pieces of evidence after another, and I'm looking at this suit, I'm looking at this big picture of the Patterson-Gimlin film on the wall, and I'm looking back at the suit, and I'm handling this Dinel fur and looking at this zipper, and I'm saying, son of a bitch. And just like Tom was saying, that movie sucked me in really good. And in a perverse way, I gotta thank Roger Patterson, because he did a good enough job to suck in a whole generations of Bigfoot lovers, researchers, whatever you want. The fact that it's a fake is really unfortunate. He did a pretty good job, because he certainly fooled me for years and years and years. But when you meet Philip Morris and you see that suit, I walked away from there just shaking my head, laughing at myself, laughing at everybody else, and just, it was a wonderful experience. That guy was incredible.
Well, you know, I want to thank you very much. You tell the story just like you were, Philip Morris. And ladies and gentlemen, if those of you who know Philip, those of you who have met Philip, you know what we're saying is straight on, spot on. The guy is a pillar of his community.
Let me jump in here, Tom, and say, not only is he a pillar of his community and an extremely nice guy, but he is absolutely filthy rich. I mean, the last thing he needs is any publicity. This is small potatoes to him. He was just looking back at this thing that happened so many years ago and chuckling that it all turned out the way it did.
And you know what? All he wants is the just due for everyone involved. And the people who have been scorned, okay, need some kind of restitution here. I really believe that. I don't know about you, but it's a sin what's happened here. And these people, I'm trying to hope that there's some good left in this world, and that people out there now will say, you know what? Take a look at this. Maybe they're right. Okay? Just give us that one iota. Take a look at the evidence, ladies and gentlemen, and you'll see it yourself. Before we bring on the man that has picked this film apart, I want Michael to stay on and tell us the story, Michael, about your book, and tell us about the skullduggery and the craziness that's going on.
Okay.
In this Bigfoot world,
in all fairness, I have to say that the skullduggery that I outline in my book, of which there's a great deal, was not directly directed at me, and most of the skullduggery was uncovered by other people. But these are the things the Rick Dyers, who whipped up that Bigfoot suit in a freezer a few years back, and then whipped up a new one and made a film about it out west. Rick Dyer just seems to never quit, and people still buy into him. There's people now who, even after his most recent Bigfoot fake body was shown, which is a very nice picture of it in my book, who still say, well, I know Rick, and that may be a fake, but I'm sure he's got the real body stashed away somewhere. I mean, hello? This naivete on the part of a lot of people is, I don't understand it. My whole take on Bigfoot has been, quote, if in doubt, throw it out. When it comes to Bigfoot evidence, stories, footprints, hair, poop, sightings, whatever. If it's got anything iffy about it, forget it. This is too ripe an area for screwing around in. And one thing after another, you get the that guy, Tom, what's his name, standing up in Canada with his stupid photographs. He sucked in that poor guy from, what is it, nice guy too, has the TV show where he goes out alone. Anybody chip in here with that name? Todd Standing is another example. Melba Ketchum is probably one of the worst examples of, and this was once again, like when I saw the Patterson film, my little heart started beating. I thought, oh, isn't this great? And a few years back, like maybe 6 years ago, five, 6 years ago, Melba Ketchum's a veterinarian who runs a DNA lab in Texas, and probably a lot of people, if you have heard of her, she got, people started sending her, she agreed to undo a DNA study of, quote, Bigfoot, unquote, samples that were going to be sent to her, hair, scat, fingernails, whatever. And she got, everybody said, okay, fine. They sent these down to Melba, who took a look at one sample and announced to Wally Hersom, a friend of mine, very rich guy, nice guy, from California, who was funding Melba's research. Melba announced that the DNA from this sample was half human and half what she, and I'm using her words, angel DNA. And she called it angel DNA because she said she couldn't find anything in the DNA data banks that would match up with it. So it was half human and half something else. She called it angel. And everybody, including me, went, all right, now we got the, finally, we got the Holy Grail. We got a doctor scientist here doing DNA studies. You know, this one's in the bag. Now we can sort of prove it, at least scientifically, that we've got an unquote unknown primate. Well, it turned out $500,000 later that Melba Ketchum was, pardon my French, full of shit. Absolute nonsense. Her studies, nobody would publish her studies. They were all considered absolute crap. She was found out to be a liar. She went bankrupt. Then still has, if you go on Facebook, you will find a few Melba Ketchum believers, and oh my God, how can you talk that way about this magnificent scientist? You know, she's tried so hard and nobody understands her, blah, 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 blah. Well, it's nonsense. And unfortunately, once again, folks, we were all let down. And I can only hope that sooner or later there's another DNA study that's going to come along, or, and I sort of hate to say it, a logging truck's going to nail one in the middle of the night, and that'll just solve the whole problem.
Why don't we get to the, apparently you're saving the best for last. Why don't we get to the coup de grace? The man that has taken in so many people. He has a Bigfoot show that I don't know if it's canceled or it's still going on or whatever. One that you happen to know personally.
Oh, okay. You mean Matt
Moneymaker?
Him and you mean Matt Moneymaker and the BFRO?
There you go.
Well, the BFRO is Bigfoot Field Research Organization. So started by Matt Moneymaker, who was a guy who went to law school, never passed the bar, and decided to start a Bigfoot expedition, quote, expeditions thing, which is we'll take people out for money and we'll go around in the woods and we'll look for Bigfoot. And he started doing this, and a lot of people like to do it. You get to wear little red headlamps and carry two-way radios, and in groups of 5, 10, or 20, you walk around down forest roads at night and hope that something's going to happen. Well, I was naive because I'd become a Bigfoot researcher for maybe 5, 6, 7 years before I even heard of the BFRO. And when I did, I thought, oh, geez, you mean there's another group of people out there that are doing this, and he said, misery loves company or whatever. I wanted people that I could meet that I could talk to about Bigfoot, because it's not the kind of thing you talk to with your neighbors very much, because they're not interested in it and they think you're crazy. So I joined the BFRO, paid $300 for one expedition, then I paid $300 for another expedition, and when you paid that much money, you got sworn in as an investigator. Now, an investigator for the BFRO means you get to go on trips for free now. However, as of now, there are so many, quote, investigators that they're beginning to crowd out the paying public. So now the investigators have to pay $100 each every time they want to go along. Anyway, Matt Moneymaker and I became, over the years, I will admit, we became pretty good friends. And I was the only one on these trips. I had a thermal imager, and I had some night vision. Nobody else had any, including Matt, had anything at all, except flashlights, which, you know, that doesn't get you very far. So consequently, nobody was seeing anything, and whenever I'd go on one of these trips, everybody wanted to use my equipment, which was fine. I didn't mind at all, but I was sort of wondering and shaking my head, what's going on here? What I soon realized is that it's a money-making proposition, plain and simple, and that in reality, if you take a whole group of people out in the woods, you're really not very likely to run into a Bigfoot. It just isn't going to happen. But what else are you going to do? So Matt and I became good friends, and I ended up, and this is too long a story to tell here, but I ended up down in North Carolina a few years back getting a 3-minute thermal video, which is called the Squeaky Thermal, Squeaky based after squeaky bathroom toys, because that was one of the things I used to leave out. And that thermal, I took the video, got it copyrighted, and I took it to Matt Moneymaker, who said, "Whoa, this is great!" And it was pretty good video. You can see it on YouTube, and you can read about it in the book Sasquatch for Sale. Took it to Matt. Matt said, "This is great. Okay, I'll tell you what I'm going to do for you, Mike. Since we're such good friends, I'm going to put a big ad on the front page of the VFRO website with a 10-second clip of your thermal video directing people to go to a website that you, Mike, are going to build, where for $2 or $3 people can go and watch the thermal video." And having no experience in this whatsoever, I said, "Yeah, that sounds like a pretty good idea." So I set up a website, arranged for, you know, credit cards and all that sort of thing, and sat back. And I'm not one to really go on Facebook or follow stuff on the internet much. I really do my research by myself at this point. And so it's running along for a couple of months, and then somebody calls me up and said, "Mike, have you seen the BFRO ad about your thermal lately?" And I said, "No." So I went to the front page of the BFRO, and there it says, I should add, we had Matt and I had a signed contract that I had drawn up by an intellectual property attorney in which it detailed what he could do, 10 or 15 second clip, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, on the BFRO site, it said, "Mike Green has shot this great video. You can go to his website and pay $3 and watch the 3-minute video, or you can watch the best 2 minutes of it here for free."
Oh, Jesus.
For free. Hello. And this is a guy supposed to be my friend. Anyway, I blew my cork, and I called him up and told him, you know, to take it down right away, or I'm going to sue your ass. And indeed, he did take it down. But the fact that he did this, I have never been able to understand. To this day, I don't understand why he would do that to me. I know.
Let me ask you this, okay? Yeah. We're coming to the last 12 minutes of the second hour. Melba Ketchum went bankrupt for $500,000 from taking money or
yep.
from people or what have you. I understand also in your book that Matt Moneymaker went bankrupt also.
Yes. Oh, yes. That's right. I forgot about that. Shortly after this little debacle with me, he borrowed $25,000 on a handshake deal from not Wally Hersom, but another fairly well-off friend of mine who had been helping him out another Bigfoot aficionado, took $25,000 in cash on a handshake deal and then declared bankruptcy and just walked away from it. No, thank you very much. Here's my bankruptcy notice. You know, take a hike, buddy.
Okay, so that was one. And this other gentleman, Wally something or another, how much did he screw him out of?
Well, Wally was voluntary, unfortunately. Wally volunteered to pay Matt. It was at one point it was up to $25,000 a month in order to get. Wally realized that the BFRO wasn't going to go anywhere if they didn't have any night vision equipment. So Wally began paying Matt $25,000 a month and supplied him with a whole lot more money. I don't know how much to buy a number of maybe five or six large thermal imagers, what we call R2D2s, that sit on the roof of a car, and then the R2000s, which are the little handheld ones. So they had maybe a dozen thermal imagers, and I don't know how many night vision devices, and a whole lot of DVR video recorders to download anything they caught with them. And they lugged this stuff all over the country. Plus, Matt was getting $25,000 a month.
Yeah, how many months?
Pardon?
Do you know for how many months he was getting 25 large?
A couple of years. Then finally, Wally, what happened to be at one of these expeditions, and there's like 50 people milling around in a parking lot with little stupid little headlamps on, and Wally said, you know, Matt, this just doesn't seem to be going anywhere. And Matt said, yeah, I guess maybe not. And Wally said, okay, that's it. Bank's closed. Take a hike. And walked away from it.
Let me see if I can do the math here. I'm not a
okay, try 25,000 times 24, whatever that is.
Well, yeah, it's $600,000 in
okay,
my...
and then you declare bankruptcy.
So just between these two people of Moneymaker and Melber Ketchum, there's $1 million.
Yes, yeah.
I'm sorry for that man. Never met him.
Wally is one of the nicest guys I've ever met. He's really straight, and he was interested in Bigfoot. Luckily for Wally, he is so wealthy that this $1 million is like chump change to him. So this him, it wasn't a big deal.
To me, it's an
extraordinary deal.
You bet. You bet. And hold on, Mike. I want to. We've got 9 minutes left, and I want to bring in our guy that has tore this film apart, Leroy Blevins. Leroy, are you out there?
Yes, I am, Tom.
How are you this evening?
All right. How you doing?
Thanks. It's been a compelling show, hasn't it?
Oh, yes.
Who would have known almost 2 hours, ladies and gentlemen? We're 7 minutes shy of that. But I want to give the last 7 minutes to you. Why don't you tell us what you depicted in that film, the most prominent things that people need to look for. And it's on our website, ladies and gentlemen. You go to the Hoax of the Century, and there's Word, and there's PDF, whichever you might have on your thing. And you'll get to see the compilation of pictures that he has done that sent over to us. So you've got 8 minutes. Tell us everything.
Okay, well, first off, you could tell it's actually a suit. The way Bob Hieronymus was walking in it, you can see the part of the pants where it bunches up. You can see fur comes untucked around the buttocks area. And also, you can also tell that it was Bob Hieronymus in the suit as well, because if you watch the walk, you'll see him push off on his right foot. Okay, well, that's the same way Bob Hieronymus walks. He always pushes off on his right foot. Okay, now, a lot of people don't know, which I got a lot of hassle from, because I actually made a copy of the suit, which you should have it on your website as well.
Yes, it's pretty damn close to another one. It looks just like it.
Well, see, even John Green himself seen the images, and he says that's the closest to the film that he's ever seen. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not no costume maker, but, you know, I went ahead and made the suit just to find out if a man can make the suit, you know. And when I made the suit, I got a lot of hassle for it, okay? And everything was like Bob Hieronymus says, when you have that suit on, now this is from first hand because I had the suit on, and the suit I made, I had it on, and it was like 80 degree weather, and you could sweat real bad in there, you get claustrophobic with it on, and everything else.
You know, I'm I want to interrupt you here. I'm looking at this one picture where as Hieronymus is in the suit coming to the tree line, and to the left, I'm seeing is that a human being, a face?
Yes, that's Bob Gimlin.
That's Bob Gimlin right there.
Yes.
Wow. So what was he doing? Giving him directions or what?
Well, see, with the suit on, you cannot hear nothing. All you can hear is yourself breathing. And they needed somebody close to Bob Hieronymus to let him know when to go or if he had to stop or if they had to reshoot. So you always got to have somebody close to the actor that's in the suit. So that's why Bob Gimlin was standing behind the brushes there. Now, a lot of people say, oh, well, that's either
why is it that you, being a layman, not, you know, are you a, you have a photography background?
Yes,
that you can go into and decipher things like this, or
yes.
How come the people who have tore this supposedly film apart and they couldn't find this, but you did?
Well, that's because they're not a film and photo analyst like I am. I'm a film and photo analyst. I've been a film and photo analyst for over 20 years. I also restore images. I restore films. I even colorize old black and white images, restore them. And when I analyze a film, I go frame by frame, and I base everything on what I see in the film.
And I see what you've done here where it shows the close-up of the face, and it shows Bob Gimlin,
mm-hmm.
And you see the actual eyes, the nose. Oh, my God, this is phenomenal.
Yeah.
And then I understand that John Green is in here also.
Yes. There was some editing done to the film because you can actually see an image walking across in front of the camera on the second part of the Bigfoot walking.
Mm-hmm.
Well, a lot of, even in the clear frames, it's a blurry image. So they kept on saying, well, it's an S tree. So I went ahead and took that S tree that they was talking about and trying to line it up. It wouldn't line up whatsoever. So I said, well, let's take some images from other people and see if they don't match. Well, when I went to the tracking dog film, you'll see John Green, he walks in this S shape when he walks. So I went ahead and I said, well, let me take a stock profile of him and try to overlay this over the image because it looks like it's in an S shape, but, you know, it's walking because you can see it when the film's in motion. You'll see where he's filming, but you see this blurry image walk across the front of the camera. So I went ahead and took the side profile of John Green and lined it up, and it was a perfect match.
Wow. This is phenomenal, just totally phenomenal. Tell me about the prints, because they sure as hell don't look like the same prints. Well, tell us about the foot pad of the creature, where you show it so distinctively.
Well, see, what I did was I cleared up the images a lot, especially when it came to the feet, to see what the feet looks like. So as I was clearing them up, which is a long process to clear up an image, and as I was clearing it up, you could see that the bottom soles of the feet look like a pair of Ray Wallace's shoes that they attached to the suit.
Wow. Well, none of those prints, okay?
None of the prints in the film matches the feet on the Bigfoot.
No, hell no. Hell no. I can see that distinctively. I mean, and, you know, the ironic thing here is, what do you think about the skullduggery that was done here? And you know, of course we're being bashed because it's become an icon in the industry, okay?
Yeah.
So, you know, we're the bad guys, right? We're mm-hmm. the hoaxers, we're this, we're that, we're everything else that comes along. But what do you have to say to these people after analyzing the film that you did, what you know, and what we all know, and after hearing what you heard here tonight? What's the culmination?
Well, see, what really it is all these haters don't take the time to sit down and talk to the person themselves. Okay, they believe in the lies that people post on the Internet or these bloggers. okay, and it based everything on what they say. Just like when there was a when I first came out with the suit, someone says, hey, Lew Blevins made the suit, but it cost him thousands of dollars, and it took him 10 years to make it. Well, if they came and actually asked me directly, no, it only took me 3 days to make the suit, and I only spent $243 for the materials for the suit.
Okay, we got 1 minute left. You made a challenge to Mr. Bob Gimlin, and I'd like to see if you want to do that again here on our show.
Yeah, I was sit there and I made a challenge a few years ago, and I'll make it again, where I said if Bob Gimlin could sit down and take two lie detectors tests like Bob Hronis did in front of a camera, and if he passes them tests, I'll go ahead and turn over all of my research and even a copy of the suit I made to him for nothing.
And you'll be done with it.
Hey, excuse me. I want to kick in there. It's Mike
Green.
And
I'll back out from there.
$500.
You'll do what?
I'll kick in $500 for Gimlin.
I'll tell you what. You put in $500, I'll put in $5,000. Okay?
Hey, he's going to be a rich man pretty soon.
So, Mr. Gimlin, you've got $5,500 and a man that is out there telling you that you're a liar. Now, the only way that you can come out of this, you want to make $5,500? Do you want to get this man's research and shut him up, plus the suit? You got a chance. Contact us. We're high profile like you, my friend. Till next time, America, kudos and salutations.
And, Tom, I'm going to make an announcement. I'm going to make an announcement at the end here for all the listeners out there. For all the listeners out there, if you happen to miss any part of this program, you can dial in and listen to the recording on your phone at 641-715-3649. That's 641-715-3649. And there's an access code, 147-443-POUND. 147-443-POUND. We'll see you next week. Good night.
Good night.
Night.
Well, folks, once again, it's time to say so long. We'd like to thank Mr. Tom Biscardi and his guests and the Bigfoot team for joining us, and we'd especially like to thank you, our listeners, for tuning in. This is Marco Bill saying see you next Wednesday evening for some more Bigfoot Live radio show entertainment with Mr. Tom Biscardi and his team. And until then, keep the Bigfoot live and keep Bigfooting. See you next week.
Three men with a gold and a pack that they'd hold and a promise till the day that they died. Answers to the questions no one's found before. Driving determination, the only key they had to unlock the door. Monsters, mysteries, legend, pain.